everybody. Come back to the Book of Revelation tonight. Got to finish some business from last week. I didn't quite get to the end. All right, let's lead us in prayer to get started. Going once, going twice. Volunteer. Thank you, Clark. Appreciate it.
Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name. Thank you so much for this opportunity that we can gather together and study from your word and see the things that you want us to see about how our relationship should be with the government. We pray for Jeff that he can remember the things he's prepared to say to us, and we pray for all of us as listeners that will listen attentively and with open hearts. Pray that you be with us after we depart here this evening and return to our homes, and that we'll be a good example to the rest of the world around us. It's in your son's name that we pray. Amen.
Come on in. Find a seat where you can. All right, so last week we made a pivot. We'll talk a little bit more about how God views human government. And so remember, we started the book of Daniel, and we looked at those two, essentially the same vision, but given kind of in two different metaphors, two different idioms. Remember, God gives Nebuchadnezzar the dream of the four kingdoms, four coming kingdoms, his own being already in existence. And remember, what was the kind of the image that God gave Nebuchadnezzar of the coming empires? What did his dream look like? Yeah, it was a statue, kind of, you know, something that resembled a human. It was human. It was humane. And of course, then there were the four different metals. The subsequent empires, from his own Babylonian to the Medo-Persian to the Greeks, and to the Romans. And the word that we noticed in chapter 2, when Daniel interpreted it, was each of them is inferior to, and remember, we talked about, that's not how we do world history, though. Which do we look at as being more, more memorable in terms of world history, the Babylonian Empire or the Roman Empire? Definitely the Roman, yeah, absolutely. And yet, that's not what God says to Nebuchadnezzar when Daniel interprets it. These are not, we're not growing in civilization, we're not growing in technology, we're not growing in artistic or literary achievement. It's inferior. And so then you flip to Daniel chapter 7, where much later in the story, Daniel now is given a vision by God himself. He's not interpreting someone else's, he has the vision. And this vision, again, is of the four coming empires. When God gives Daniel this vision, it's right on the verge of the Babylonian passing away. It's decades after that first vision that Nebuchadnezzar had. Only when God shows essentially the same message to Daniel, what imagery does God use for Daniel? Remember?
Animals.
Yeah, these sending animals or beasts. Until you get to the last one, and how is the last one described? What animal is it?
Terrible.
Terrible, terrifying, whatever. And remember, we talked in class, what's the significance of God showing, essentially, same message, same idea, coming empires. What was the significance of God showing Nebuchadnezzar kind of this humane image, statue, versus Daniel sees beasts, culminating in Rome as this terrifying monster, not even describable by any other animal, so fierce and terrifying and awful was it. What's the significance of those two different ways of articulating the same idea? Remember, we talked about this a little bit. Remember? Treatment of his people is the issue. That's right. It's not about science or technology or artistic accomplishment or, good laws and good roads or whatever. It's about how the people of God are treated. And what did you say, Vicki?
The second one is how God sees it.
Oh, yes. Again, when we do the story of world history, we're getting better. From Babylon to Rome, that's an improvement in human society, civilization. But what does God see? From petting zoo to monster, they're getting worse in God's eyes. And so part of what we've got to do when it comes to God and government in the first place is we need to recover God's own vision of nations, including our own. Right? You know, sometimes, again, we get so stuck thinking inside the box, Republican versus Democrat, we're going to make America great again, or we're going to build back better, you know, whichever team you're on. You know, we get caught inside the box arguing within the assumptions of, you know, somehow that we can fix the country or make it great. And we forget that as Christians, we need to not be caught in the box, in the argument. We need to be outside the box, outside the argument, and see what God actually sees. That makes sense? And that's what's going on for Daniel. That's what's going on in the book of Revelation. And those two books, remember, then we went to Revelation 12, Revelation 13, where Daniel is very much Revelation, where John is very much using Daniel's imagery, right? Why? Because he's talking about the same types of things, which is now for Christians living under Rome, terrifying monsters are afoot. Under the control of who or what? Satan. You know, and we don't need to have some sort of, you know, farcical Hollywood version of possession, demon possession or something. You know, the ways in which Satan can work through civil government, the way Satan can work through culture, the way Satan can work through false religion, you know, it's more sophisticated than something we're just going to, you know, plausible, some sort of demon possession at work. But at the end of the day, these beasts do and accomplish not God's purposes, but Satan's. And one of Satan's great purposes, of course, is to destroy the people of God. And so especially that frightening line at the end of chapter 12, where the dragon, now angry because he couldn't destroy the seed of woman, Jesus, goes off to make war on the woman's children, us, the other descendants of the people of God. You know, and so that's what we're up against. And so he calls other monsters, what we would call civil government, what we would call culture and religious authority. He calls these things to be used to hassle the people of God. And remember, when we ran out of time last week, we were kind of right at the end of chapter 13, beginning of chapter 14. As always, the chapter breaks are in the wrong place. Almost always in your Bible, they're not where they should be. And so we're making breaks where we need not make breaks in very important scenes. And so in chapter 13, this second beast, and again, we're not going to spend a lot of time exegeting all that goes into understanding what these beasts are. This is not a class in Revelation for its own sake. But this second beast, by and large, represents what we would call cultural and religious power. You know, remember, sometimes the state really does use religious imagery or religious ideas to get its own purposes across, right? Why do some denominations put out voters' guides during election season? Or remember at the very beginning of the season when we played that clip from First Baptist Dallas where the choir is singing, "Make America Great Again." Nothing new in human history about church and state actually being combined. And it's not that the church purifies the state corrupts the church. That's also what history teaches us. The church religion in general becomes a means of power. That's why, by the way, in Middle Ages Europe, if the king was a Catholic, what did you have to be? And if the king was a Protestant, what did you have to be? And the king wanted a divorce, what were you? Anglican. All right. All right. That's a little coronation humor for you folks. All right. Watch all that play out yesterday, man. Archbishop of Canterbury, there's a reason the Pope wasn't there, and that's why. Ask Henry VIII. So when you get to chapter 13 and this other beast, this represents, again, more cultural and religious power in a culture. And its way of putting pressure on people to do things. And that's what the mark of the beast was always about, being marked on their forehead or their right hand. It wasn't in their world literally, you know, we joked about this last week, it's not about, you know, getting microchipped or you know, getting a barcode or, you know, implanted in you or tattooed on you or something like that. In their world, it was simply affirming what the government said you had to affirm that religiously was wrong. And so in their world, literally, especially in Asia Minor, if you wanted to buy and sell what we call a business license today, you had to have a certificate from the imperial cult where you had gone to a temple to the Roman emperors and you had burned a pinch of incense and said, "Caesar is Lord." And then you could have your certificate and then you could go and have your business buy and sell, do whatever you needed to do. What's the problem with a Christian doing that?
Caesar's not Lord.
Caesar, yeah. Caesar is not Lord. Who's Lord?
Lord.
Jesus Christ. Yeah. And that goes back to, by the way, in the larger context of Revelation, because that's the real issue for the churches in Asia Minor. That's why the portrayal of the lordship of Jesus is so strong at the beginning of the book. because this is the issue. He is the Almighty. He is Pantocrator, not the Roman Emperor, who claimed as much. Again, classic Revelation, we had more time. One of the great claims of that emperor who was on the throne at the time of Revelation is where the guy named Domitian, thank you. Yeah, Domitian. He actually issued a coin of his infant son sitting on the world with seven stars over it, and then the child reaching for the seven stars. What's that message? Who's Lord and divine? Me and my kid. And so, by the way, that's part of the imagery in Revelation. Who holds seven stars in the beginning of the book of Revelation? Jesus does. Probably literally meant to be a slam on Domitian's coin. He is not what he claims to be, but Christians need to remember that. But what's the problem if you decide not to go to the temple and burn your pinch of incense and say Caesar is Lord? Yeah. Is your kid going to get an A&M? Let's modernize it. Is your kid getting an A&M? You opening that small business you've been saving up years to do? You're gonna be allowed to take the bar exam? You're gonna be allowed to go to med school? See how this works? You're gonna be getting your certification to be a public school teacher? See how this works? But I gotta feed my family. God knows that. Well, ask Antipas about that earlier in the book, who's already died. Pretty weak excuse. So that's the challenge. And everybody in the book of Revelation, everybody in life gets a mark. Not a barcode, not a computer chip, but everybody gets a mark that can be seen by God. Those who decide to sell out get the mark of the beast. But you turn the page, it breaks in the wrong place because this is meant to be the exact opposite scene. Beginning of what we call chapter 14, I also looked and behold, on Mount Zion stood the Lamb. Oh, there's another creature roaming about, but it's the Lamb. Who's that? And with him are 144,000 who had his name and his father's name written where? Where did the mark of the beast go? Everybody gets a mark. Everybody in life gets a mark. Whose mark's on you? That's what this book is saying. Everybody gets marked. Whose mark is on you? So these 144,000, which is just a symbolic number for all of God's people, had his name and his father's name written on their foreheads. And I heard a voice from heaven like the roar of many waters and like the sound of loud thunder. The voice I heard was like the sound of harpists playing on their harps. They were singing a new song before the throne and the four living creatures and the elders. No one could learn the song except the 144,000 who had been redeemed from the earth. It is these who have not defiled themselves with women, for they are virgins. It is these who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. Now, wait a second, the Lamb's back in heaven. Right? I mean, Jesus ascended back. That's why John had to start his vision by there's a door into heaven. So in what sense does the text mean that these are the people who follow the Lamb wherever he goes? Obedience. Say again?
Obedience.
Obedience even unto
death.
Where did the Lamb go? In fact, why does this book want to call him the Lamb? Of all the things and metaphors we have in the Bible for Jesus and who he is, he was the Lion of the tribe of Judah, all these other numbers, he is overwhelmingly the Lamb in this book. Why? Because he refused to be marked by the beast. Because he refused to play the game. And he paid a terrible price for it, and now he calls his people to go and do likewise. They follow the Lamb wherever he goes. These have been redeemed, therefore, from mankind as first fruits to God and the Lamb. And look at what verse 5 says. And in their mouth no lie was found, for they are blameless. Now, in verse 5, when it says no lie was found in their mouth, it's not talking about just they don't lie, because liars are bad, lies never good, and we teach our 4-year-olds that. That's not what it's talking about. What does it mean now in this context when it says there's no lie in their mouth? What was the lie?
Caesar
is Lord. That's not true. That's a lie. And it was not found in their mouth.
Could it also imply that there's no hypocrisy there either? In other words, they weren't trying to play.
Oh, certainly. That would be part of it. Absolutely. Yeah, because the only way you can play both sides of it is to say something that's not true to somebody. I mean, yeah, absolutely. But at the end of the day, they refused to speak the culture's shibboleths, whatever they were. You know what that looks like today? That means you do not call your coworker when they're a man by a woman's name. Because that's a lie. and you don't use someone's pronoun, preferred pronouns when they're a woman and they want a man's pronouns, because that's a lie. That's what it looks like today, folks. And by the way, are we coming into a season in which there will be a price to be paid for that? Yes, we are. We're back in the first century. We've kind of been had a holiday from history for a couple hundred years.
The American government is resembling the Roman Empire.
We identified with Rome, pardon the pun, when we founded this country, and we have, in more ways than we realized, or perhaps the founders, and then we have become Rome. And again, mention this almost every week we talk about this, those of us who are raising kids. We have to be telling our kids they're going to have to accept less and be prepared to be fired, or they're going to lose their immortal souls. Because the pressure to speak a lie at work, thanks to HR, especially in this month we're about to enter into called June, which is now not called June, it's called Pride. And everybody knows when you talk about Pride or Pride Month what we're talking about anymore, right? And that's going to be the pressure, and that's the reality. But it's all a lie. It's not true. Can men marry men? It's a lie. Can women marry women? It's a lie. So the question is whether the people of God of the 21st century are going to show the courage that the people of God of the first century showed. They're not going to throw us the lions. But the truth of the matter is most of us are afraid of losing our comfortable lifestyles more than we're afraid of losing our immortal souls.
So the Nuremberg defense...
I was just following orders.
It did not work on the day of judgment either.
It didn't work in Nuremberg, even on this earth, ironically.
That's what I said either.
And no, and that's at the end of the day. That's exactly right. God knows and what he wants. And this is the thing is, we're reading this in English. One of the key words in the book of Revelation, this is probably turning into a Revelation class, I didn't mean for that, but one of the key words in the book of Revelation is martus. What word do you hear? Or what English word do you hear when I say martus? You hear the word martyr. But in Greek, a martyr was not foremost somebody who died for the cause. It was simply a witness. Now, that may get you killed, and thus how, by extension, over time, it came to mean somebody who died for the cause. But all it was just simply who... And what's a witness? A witness is somebody who gets up and tells the... They put you on the stand in the court of law as a witness to the crime. And then you put your hand on the Bible. What do you swear? Do you swear to tell the truth? The whole truth? Nothing but the truth, so help you God. That's what a witness is. And that's actually one of the key words in Revelation. It doesn't always get translated out, and we don't always recognize what's going on. We are called to be witnesses. Not in the kind of the silly evangelical sense that term's used. And now we are called to be the people who stand in front of the world and tell the truth about God, Jesus, and reality, no matter what it costs us. That's what we do. We are witnesses to the truth, the reality of God. All right, so let's keep reading. Just especially on the eve of June, can't emphasize this strongly enough. We will be judged, folks. We will be judged in the last day by this. And again, for raising kids... We've got to be teaching our kids that their soul is worth more than college acceptance, professional degrees and credentials, a six-figure job, upward mobility, or whatever it may be. Got to be teaching our kids that, downward mobility for the sake of eternal life is worth it. And if that means they don't achieve what we achieve or even have what we were able to have, so be it. Keep reading with me a little bit more here. Now I'm in verse 6. Then I saw another angel flying directly overhead with an eternal gospel to proclaim to those who dwell on the earth, to every nation, tribe, language, and people. And he said with a loud voice, "Fear God, give him glory, because the hour of his judgment has come, and worship him who made heaven and earth, sea, and springs of water." And a second angel came along and said, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great, she who made all nations drink the wine of the passion of her sexual immorality." Now, wait a second. I thought Babylon was long since fallen, historically, when this book was written. So why is Babylon popping back up here in this story?
Is it an image of Rome?
Yes. Because in the Bible, in a sense, Babylon becomes the great image of any city or empire against God. That's the era in which God, with his own people, demonstrated first and started talking about this struggle. And so now it's always Babylon, whatever the literal name of the place is. That's why Peter, who's writing from Rome in 1 Peter chapter 5, will cleverly say, "She who is in Babylon greets you." He was writing from Rome. But who now holds God's people under their thumb? You know, in Daniel's day, it was Babylon. Ezra Nehemiah's day, it was Persia. You see how this works? And Rome's day, who's pushing now? The Romans are. Who's today? The government that we spend way too much time fighting over, whether we should vote Republican or Democrat, as though it's still not the beast. How foolish. How foolish. And I'll say a little bit more about that in just a second. Then there's a third angel, verse 9. If anyone worships the beast and its image and receives a mark on his forehead or his hand, he will also drink the wine of God's wrath, poured full strength into the cup of his anger, and he will be tormented with fire and sulfur in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. You hear that? You didn't ask for this hand, but this is the hand we've been dealt. Strong language. True story. Know a man who's an elder in a church in another congregation, another part of the country, so I don't think I'm violating anything if I tell this story in this part of the country. Very successful man in business, CEO of a major division of a major corporation. Where he was at, very well connected in his industry, even would get phone calls from the Secretary of Energy. Very successful man, very intelligent man. He tells a very powerful story of one day when all the CEOs of all the various divisions were called into a meeting, kind of almost like a Daniel 3 story actually, by the kind of the CEO of the whole umbrella corporation or whatever you call it. I'm not a business guy, no MBA here. Anyways. And this guy, he says, was very anti-religious, mocked all that, just wouldn't see why anybody would be that stupid or foolish. Surely nobody on his team would be that kind of a loser. And of course, therefore, very pro all sorts of trendy social causes, like LGBTQ and things like that. And my friend, the elder, tells a very moving story of sitting in a very difficult meeting where the boss was ranting and asking different people to identify different things over the course of this meeting, sitting there in his chair thinking, is today the day I lose my career? Because he'd already decided in his heart that if the question is asked, he's going to tell the truth. If anyone gets the mark of the beast on his forehead or hand, he will also drink the wine of God's wrath, pour full strength into the cup of his anger, and he will be tormented with fire and sulfur in the presence of the holy angels and the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment goes up forever and ever. They have no rest day or night, these worshipers of the beast and its image, and whoever receives the mark of its name. And then here's the word of encouragement. We are called to endurance. That's the word you highlight, you circle, you go home with, you put on your bathroom mirror, you look at in the morning, you remind yourself as you drive to work, you remind yourself as you're home. This is the word that you hold on to. We are simply running a marathon through this world. Can you hang on for a few more miles? This is the call for the endurance of the saints who keep the commandments of God and their faith in Jesus. And I heard a voice from heaven saying, write this. Blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. Blessed indeed, said the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors, for their deeds follow them. You can rest now, or you can rest later. The choice is yours. All right. A little bit further. Then I looked and behold a white cloud, and seated on the cloud, one like a son of man. Now, wait a second. I've seen this before. Where have I seen this before? Yeah, Daniel. Who's writing in now? Who's finally showing up? Jesus is finally showing up. It's gotten bad, it's gotten rough, gotten ugly. But who's finally riding to the rescue? Jesus is. I looked and behold a white cloud, and seated on that cloud, one like the Son of Man, golden crown on his head, sharp sickle in his hand. And another angel came out of the temple, calling with a loud voice to him who sat on the cloud, put in your sickle and reap. For the hour to reap has come, for the harvest of the earth is fully ripe. So he who sat on the cloud swung his sickle across the earth, and the earth was reaped. This is what happens when Jesus finally comes in judgment. a reaping happens, finally. Question is, can you be faithful? Can you hang on there until that point? All right. Well, we've got left of class. And the other thing we need to do in this, in the book of Revelation, we need to jump ahead now. I want you to look at me in chapter 17. Chapter 17. One other aspect of the judgment of God upon the world we need to clearly understand in the context of a God in government class, and seeing what God sees, or seeing the way God sees, which is not the way you learn by watching CNN or Fox News. Even Tucker Carlson can't help you, let alone Don Lemon or Rachel Maddow, or again, pick your favorite talking head, because they're inside the box, not outside. Here's the reality. One of the seven angels who had seven bowls came to me and said, "Come, I will show you the judgment of the great prostitute who is seated on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed sexual immorality, and with the wine of whose sexual immorality the dwellers on earth have become drunk." All right, I'm going to show you the great whore of all the earth that everybody else in the world comes to fornicate with. And of course, we're not talking about literal fornication here. We're talking about spiritual. We're talking about what great country or what great empire does everybody else in the world bend to, bow to, want a piece of, want to be like, what relations with. Make sense? That's the image that's now being portrayed. I'm going to go show you who this great prostitute is. And so verse 3, he carried me away in the spirit in the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was full of blasphemous names, and it had seven heads and 10 horns. Okay, so a woman, that's our prostitute, our whore, who's sitting on what?
A red beast.
An awful beast with what? How's it described?
Seven
heads and 10 horns. Have we met this creature before? Where have we met this creature before in this book?
The dragon, 12 and 13.
It's the dragon, yeah, back in 12 and 13. So the prostitute is sitting there, or in a sense, you know, undergirded by, founded on who or what?
Satan.
This is satanic. The whore is a satanic work in the world. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet. That's the color of royalty and power. Yeah, she looks great. She's politically hot. Purple and scarlet, adorned with gold, jewels, pearls, holding in her hand a golden cup. And look what's holding in her hand. It's not, you know, her colonialism or imperialism against the world. What's the cup that she's holding that everybody wants to drink from? What's in it? Abominations and the appearance of her sexual morality. It's culture. It's culture. Right? The world wants it. And on her forehead was written the name of mystery, Babylon the Great, mother of prostitutes and of the earth's abominations. And so I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. This is a world that crushes and crunches the people of God as she intoxicates the world with her great cultural immorality. And when I saw her, I marveled greatly. And the angel said to me, "Why do you marvel? I'll tell you the mystery of the woman and the beast with seven heads and 10 horns that carried her. The beast that you saw was and is not, and is about to rise from the bottomless pit and then leap into the destruction. And the dwellers on earth, whose names have not been written in the book of life and the foundation of the world, will marvel to see the beast, because it was and is not and is to come. This calls for a mind with wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman is seated. They are also seven kings." You know what? We're not going to worry about all that, because this is not a class on Revelation. I want you to drop down verse 12. "And the 10 horns that you saw are 10 kings who have not yet received royal power, but they will receive authority as kings for 1 hour together with the beast." So their authority doesn't last that long. Humanly it feels like it, but in the great scheme of eternity, you know, what's a reign of 50 years? What's a century? In eternity's perspective. From eternity, again, you've got to see things from God's perspective. These things don't last. They may feel like it once your entire lifetime, but the truth is these things don't last. These people don't last. This power doesn't last. And verse 14, what are they going to do, verse 14? "They will make war on the Lamb, but the Lamb will eventually conquer them. He is Lord of Lords and King of Kings. And those who are with him are called chosen and faithful." Why are they called faithful? because they stuck with them. They endured, right? Keep reading. And the angel said to me, the waters that you saw were the prostitute of sea, the peoples and multitudes and nations and languages. And the ten horns you saw, they, the beast, will hate them. For sake of time, let's see. Verse 18, the woman that you saw is the great city that has dominion over the kings of the earth. All right, and so you have this prostitute under satanic power who, and let's spread that around as quickly as we can. I should have already started this with that. That basically the rest of the world wants relations with. And what does she teach the world? What does she spread among the world? Not the fear of God like Israel was called to do. That's what Israel's job was, right? Make God known to the nations. Not this prostitute. That's not what she does. She does something else. She spreads decadence, depravity, godlessness around the world. So, this article came across my desk here in recent weeks. Things that you may not even be aware of that your government, our government, does. It's not just that we promote LGBTQ amongst ourselves. We literally put pressure on the rest of the world to join in. Did you know that? That's actually a principle of official American foreign policy. Did you know we put strings attached on the money we give to nations? Did you hear what we were doing? I forget which African country recently passed a very strong anti-homosexual law, and the federal government is putting pressure on them about that. On March 20th, the United States organized a meeting of the United Nations Security Council. Oh, this is serious business. This is like World War III kind of stuff, right? You in Security Council? Are you kidding me? This is where wars are declared and planned. On the following topic, integrating the human rights of LGBTI persons into the council's mandate for maintaining international peace and security. Who's pushing that to the world? Who's pushing that to the world? We are. This effort is but another step in the American-led push to compel the entire world to adopt our progressive social agenda. In April of 2022, the Biden administration produced an interagency report on the ways in which all aspects of our government will advance gay rights around the world. These government measures dovetail with a vast network of academic programs, conferences, and legal clinics, and with foundation-funded activist organizations operating at every level. Were someone to tally the direct and indirect expenditures on gay rights and related causes, I would be surprised if they didn't reach $1 trillion per year. Quote, the ambition is simple, to strengthen the Rainbow Reich and ensure that it attains global hegemony. From Brussels to Washington, this goal is pursued by every major institution in the West, including, it seems, even the Catholic Church in Germany. Because, the cardinals in Germany are actually embracing this now in schism with the Pope. Often the Rainbow Reich is disguised by calls for the defense of liberal democracy. Of course, without exception, no country counts as liberal that does not wholeheartedly endorse the latest progressive dogmas. In effect, as the hegemon in Western initiative alliances, the United States leads an ideological crusade to conquer the world with this stuff. And if you think that's new, you're mistaken. I have in my files an article from a military publication, 2018. Who was president 2018? It wasn't Biden. Who was president 2018? Trump. About a drag queen in the Navy who had become very popular and well-liked. That was happening on whose watch? Trump's. Who was commander-in-chief in 2018? Trump. What did Trump do about it? Nothing. Not that I know of. Don't ever forget, he was the first president to own strip clubs. I'm just saying. It's not either or. It's all of it. And we got to quit arguing within the box and step outside the box. It's a beast. And if the rest of the nation wants to do business with you, imitates your culture, speaks your language and teaches your language as the second language in school, does business in your currency, hides under the umbrella of your military, you know what you are in your age? You're the beast. That's how it works in the Bible. And And that's exactly what we live under. That's exactly what we are. And part of the problem is most of us never travel internationally. You would be surprised how we are viewed overseas. And not just because of, you know, they don't like our military incursions or whatever. There are parts of the world that resent our culture and the pressure our wicked culture puts on their traditional and honestly more natural and right ways of living. We're the ones who teach their children to sin through the internet. They dress like us, they talk like us, and now they're fornicating and debasing themselves like us. That's what we are. We are the whore who teaches the world to drink from this filthy cup. And so, you know, again, if you want to vote, vote, you know, vote wisely, vote with integrity, vote, you know, vote something that you can give account to for, you know, with God on the last day. There are pros and cons to a variety of scenarios which you might not vote. But make no mistake about what reality actually is for the people of God who see things the way God actually sees it. Does that make sense? Are you with me on that? Okay, one step further. We're not quite done with Revelation yet. We're not quite done with Revelation. Chapter 17 ends then with this great statement that the woman you saw is the great city. She is the great world power of her day. Chapter 18, in the beginning of verse 1. And after this I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority. And the earth was made bright with his glory. Now keep in mind, what's being seen here in chapter 18, this is not the end of the world. This is not the end of time. This is one of God's judgments within history, okay? This is not the end, capital T, capital E. This is within history, this judgment that we're about to read about. And so this great angel with great authority calls out with a mighty voice, verse 2, fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. She has become a dwelling place for demons, a haunt for every unclean spirit, a haunt for every unclean bird. Here he's quoting from Old Testament judgment passage against the true, literal ancient Babylon. And by the way, where was that ancient Babylon by the time this was actually being written literally? It was a ruin in what we now call the Iraqi desert already by then. And so part of the power of using Babylon language and using Old Testament judgment against Babylon language is, has it already come to pass literally for that city? Yeah. So if God starts invoking it about you, what should you think? He'll do it again. Don't try him. He'll do it again. He's already done that to literal Babylon, already a dwelling of jackals and ostriches. Don't try him. Verse 3, for all the nations have drunk the wine of the passion of her sexual immorality. The kings of the earth have committed immorality with her. The merchants of the earth have grown rich from her power, luxurious living. We call that globalization today. I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, lest you take part in her sins. No, you just got to vote for the right person. No, that's not the application, is it? What's the application? Get out of it altogether. See yourself as an outsider to this. Come out of her, my people, lest you take part in her sins, lest you share in her judgments and plagues. For her sins are heaped high as heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. Pay her back, as she herself has paid back others. Repay her double for her deeds. Makes a double portion for her in the cup she has mixed. As she glorified herself and lived in luxury. Okay, is that applicable to our time and place? Yeah. As she lived in luxury, so give her a like measure of torment and boring and mourning. Since in her heart she says, I sit as a queen, I am no widow, and mourning I shall never see. In other words, I'll never fall. Do we think we could fall? Does the establishment, the elites of this country ever speak in terms of our fall as even being a possibility? Really? No, it's beyond our imagination. The world without America? Are you kidding me? Yeah, we're not the first ones to think that way. I will see no mourning. For this reason, her plagues will come in a single day. What's the significance of that? How quickly it's actually going to happen when it happens to Rome. Single day. Remember the shock of 9/11? Remember the shock of COVID? God jerks the chain sometimes to remind us, you'd be amazed how quick I can completely reorient the world if I choose to. Use the Haggai's image. I can shake the nations whenever I please. In a single day it will happen to the woman who thinks it will never happen. Death, mourning, famine, she will be burned with fire, for mighty is the Lord God who has judged her. And the kings of the earth who committed sexual immorality and lived in luxury with her, they'll weep and wail over her when they see the smoke of her burning. It's not that they really loved her, it's just, listen, she was our sugar daddy. Our economy is tied to her economy. Our currency is pegged to her currency. You know, their economy collapses, what happens to ours? It's not that they love us. It's just, without milking us, they're in bad shape too. Who's going to protect them from other aggressor nations then, right? See how this works? They will stand far off, though, in fear of her torment, saying, "Alas, alas, you great city, you mighty city Babylon, for in a single hour your judgment has come. And the merchants of the earth will weep and mourn for her, since no one buys their cargo anymore." The merchants of the earth, so yeah, all the investors in the financial class, it'll be so sad when our economy collapses. Because who are they going to do business with now? Where are they going to sell all these luxury goods they make? Because if you notice the list, no one buys their cargo anymore. It's cargoes of gold, silver, jewels, pearls, fine linen, purple cloth, silk, scarlet cloth, all kinds of scented wood, all kinds of articles of ivory, all kinds of articles of costly wood, bronze, iron, marble, cinnamon, spice, incense, myrrh, frankincense, wine, oil, fine flour, wheat, cattle, sheep, horses, chariots, and slaves. That is, human souls. Those aren't necessities, folks. That list is luxuries. Because this is what again, part of how you know you're the prostitute. What's your shopping list look like? What drives your economy? We call our economy a consumption economy. You ever heard that? We are consumers. We are a consumption. We're not a producing economy anymore. We sent that, because those are poor paying jobs. We sent those to, Chinese, who will do it for pennies an hour, right? Everybody knows, Nike, Apple, famous for sweatshop prices and huge profits when they sell them back to us, right? Everybody know that story? It's what we do. And so all these container ships come across the ocean full of flat screens and electronics, luxuries, not necessities, including the ultimate degradation of human beings themselves. We even trade in lives. The fruit for which your soul longed has gone from you. All your delicacies and splendors are lost to you, never to be found again. The merchants of these wares who gained wealth from her. That's why, the irony, China, both wants Taiwan back, but China also loves making money off us. I mean, that's kind of the economic perpetual motion machine. They loan us the money to buy their stuff. I mean, that's kind of the craziness of the economy we built. But the merchants of these wares who gain wealth from her will stand far off in fear of her torment, weeping aloud. Alas, alas, for the great city that was clothed in fine linen, purple and scarlet, adorned with gold, jewels, and pearls. For in a single hour, all this wealth has been laid waste. And all the shipmasters and seafaring men. See, now this is the transportation sector going down now. All the shipmasters and seafaring men, sailors, and all who trade is on the sea, stood far off and cried out as they saw the smoke of her burning. What city was like the great city? Remember the supply chain crisis of a couple years ago? All those ships off the Pacific ports?
Yeah.
Or just a little taste of this, maybe. Maybe God kind of, for those with eyes to see and ears to hear, kind of said, hey, I can really rattle your economy far easier than you realize. Remember how we were all concerned? Can't find baby formula, can't find this, can't find that.
Yeah.
Yeah, God says, it's not just COVID maybe at work. Maybe I'm at work in COVID. Maybe I'm trying to wake you up. Because you're the prostitute. And I'm especially trying to wake my people up. Come out of her instead of being worried about her. And they threw dust on their heads as they wept and mourned, crying out, "Alas, alas, for the great city where all who had ships at sea grew rich by her wealth." For again, and what's the theme over and over again? For in a single hour. If you're a highlighter or underline your Bible, you go through this chapter and you mark how many times that's the refrain. For a single hour she's been laid waste. But here's the interesting thing. Verse 20. Rejoice over her. Oh, that's a sudden change of language. But who gets to rejoice? You saints and apostles and prophets, for God has given judgment for you against her. Let me ask you something. If America was to suffer devastating setbacks on the order of what this is talking about, things that maybe in the recent years we've seen a little, example of God's mercy or God's warning shots, quick taste of, would you be able to rejoice, or would you feel like your whole life had gone down with it? Because what was the admonition earlier in this chapter to God's people on earth? Come out. Be separate. Where is your emotional, mental, and spiritual identity at? Would you actually see this? I mean, I'm not saying it'd be fun to live through. I mean, I think about like Habakkuk. Habakkuk, when God told Habakkuk about Babylon coming to judge the wickedness that he was so concerned about, rightly so, among his own people, and God said, "Oh, no, don't worry, Habakkuk. I'm going to deal with the wickedness of your time. I'm saying the Babylonians will destroy you." Well, now you know. Okay, good, but wait a second. You know, I got to eat too. And that's why Habakkuk chapter 3 is very powerful, because that's where Habakkuk makes peace with, even if everything collapses, I'm going to rejoice in God. It's not fun to go through, but depending on where your identity is, and whether we get back to accepting, we're in the middle of a spiritual war, folks. In fact, that's the language earlier in Revelation, war in heaven, and it's come down to earth. Whether we get back and identifying, to use the language of the day, as saints, people of God, more than Americans, more than Republicans or Democrats or Independents or Greens or Constitutional Party or whatever. Doesn't matter. What does God see when he looks down at us? He sees a beast. He sees a prostitute that is rampantly corrupting the entire world of this generation. That's what he sees. And Republicans or Democrats, nobody's putting that genie back in the bottle, because the truth of the matter is Republicans are, you know, granted that if you can grant that the Democratic Party has certainly already bought all in on this, the Republican Party is rapidly accepting more and more of it if you have eyes to see it.
Started in 1969 with Ronald Reagan, called divorce.
Ironically, that's right. St. Ronald Reagan, for conservatives, literally signed the first no-fault divorce law in the nation when he was governor of California. And if you really stop and think about it, gay marriage is not when we redefine marriage. That's when we redefine marriage.
He was the first president to get one.
Ironically, yeah. He's a Hollywood man first. But yeah, that's when we redefine marriage, because now we change marriage, you know, divorce from being adultery, you know, or at least some other, you know, reasonable things. To now, you know, we're just, you know, irreconcilable differences.
Breaking up.
Yeah, breaking up. But Ronald Reagan, that's when we redefine marriage. People forget that. So again, you tell me, what does God see? Right? Okay. Rejoice, O heaven, and you saints, apostles, prophets, are God given judgment for you against her. And a mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone and threw it into the sea, saying, so will Babylon, the great city, be thrown down with violence and will be no more. And the sound of harpists and musicians, of flute players and trumpeters will be heard in you no more. And a craftsman of any craft will be found in you no more. And basically, just drop down. Well, now keep reading. And the sound of the mill will be heard in you no more. Light of a lamp will shine in you no more. Voice of the bridegroom and bride will be heard in you no more. Complete social collapse as well. For your merchants were the great ones of the earth, and all nations were deceived by your sorcery, by your great wickedness. And in her was found the blood of the prophets and the saints, of all who have been slain on the earth. All right, so there it is. That's one of our great capstone pieces this quarter to, you know, resetting ourselves and our perspective. It's a beast. It's a prostitute. Doesn't matter who's president. Be honest about the limits of politics and politicians, and learn to see what God sees. And therefore, do not be surprised if and when the judgment comes. Because we have certainly taught the world staggering immorality, have we not? We are now literally trying to teach the world there's no such thing as man and woman. We are literally teaching the world to rebel against Genesis 1. Think about that. Genesis 1, something as basic as, in the beginning, he created them male and female. And it's bad enough that we decided that we don't believe that for ourselves. But we're determined to take the world down this crazy train with us. You think God in heaven's not watching? So, all right. That was a little dark and heavy, but listen, we sometimes fail to listen to the whole counsel of God. And this is in the book as much as be baptized for forgiveness of sins, or, you know, hopeful stuff about hereafter. We are called to be soldiers in the Lord's army. We do not get to pick the times and places where we live. We are simply called to be faithful and endure wherever God in his providence has placed us in the story of human history. And we just have to be placed in a century in which the ripeness of the awful fruit of the sexual revolution is coming, you know, coming to bear. And God only knows how much longer he's going to put up with this. But don't be surprised an hour when the judgment comes. That's not the end of the world. That's within history. Now, Jesus could come back too. God only knows that. But God will not let this go on in history forever. So quit investing, again, so much of your time, your energy, your heart in this stuff. See what God sees. All right, see you next week.